with again, and I've been working on this for some time, is what science is left to be done. What are we aiming to try to learn in the new exploration activity? And so let's proceed with that. Of course, they're the unknown unknowns, the unknowns. And we won't know about those until we get there. And that's has been an underlying theme of several of the talks this morning, is to make sure that the crews, whether professional geologists or not, have the training to recognize these important unknown unknowns. Of course, we have not done anything in the far side or the polar regions, totally unexplored on the ground and only partially explored remotely. Global active passive geophysical networks have not been put in place, and they need to be. Our knowledge of the interior of the moon is abysmal. We're still arguing over whether there's a 500-kilometer discontinuity or not. We do have more or less, let's say, 2.5 independent determinations of the size of the lunar core, and we have some information on its history from the paleomagnetic remotely sensed data, but nevertheless, we are not very smart about the interior of the moon. Geochemical characterization of the stratigraphic and eruptive sequences in the crust has only begun. There are, though, some known issues that are defined by the knowledge we have today. I, of course, feel we need to find out ways to test the giant impact hypothesis, in particular, what were the whole moon effects, if that indeed was the way that the moon originated. One way to do that is to look at where the, right now, the Achilles heel of the giant impact hypothesis, and that's the information that comes from the pyroclastics. One of the best places to do that is, it may well be the southwestern Serenitatis, which we documented significantly from orbit, and that there's increasing amount of remotely sensed information. There are layered pyroclastic deposits down there. There's no question about that, and probably a great deal to teach us. The deep floor material and ejecta from South Pole Aiken may well fit into this test of the giant impact hypothesis, but that's almost in the category of the unknowns, in that we probably won't know whether it helps until we actually get that information. The cataclysm hypothesis, or a late heavy bombardment hypothesis, needs to be tested as well, because an awful lot had to happen in a very short amount of time, not just the impacts themselves, but a great deal of internal activity within the moon. We really need to investigate, identify, and date syngenetic samples from the old Mascon basins, non-Mascon basins. Those are the basins that stratigraphically are older than the Mascon basins. We really do not have any definitive, at least identifiable, samples of those. And referring back to Paul Spoutis's talk, it is very difficult to be absolutely sure that you have syngenetic samples of these basin-forming events. And it relates back also to our need to understand what was happening here on Earth. In fact, I think the moon ultimately will be the way we calibrate the Hadean here on Earth. It goes back to this business of identifying syngenetic samples from various basins, the Orientale Basin primarily to determine the end of the Hadean, the large impacts of that period, and then to identify whether there are episodes of impact activity within that period of the Precambrian. Also, there increasingly, in my mind at least, is becoming an important role, a potential role for pressure release in magma generation. Obviously, pressure release only works if the magma is about ready, if rocks are about ready to melt. But nevertheless, it may have been an important aspect of that period of lunar history, and investigating Mare Basalt units in Orientale may well be one of the ways in which we do that. The geophysical delineation of internal structure, the depth of the magma ocean, is still in question. Lateral extent and vertical depth of upper mantle cumulate subunits from which very probably the MG suite rocks developed as plutonic units, only to be excavated later and incorporated in the various breccia units that we have sampled and have seen. The original three-dimensional distribution of Urcrete residual liquid from the magma ocean, I think, is a very important issue. I am not yet convinced that there was not a uniform distribution of that liquid around the moon, only be disrupted by the formation of the very large basins such as South Pole Lake and more importantly, probably Procolarum. The lack of isostatic adjustment within SPA is an interesting question and may relate actually to the lack of Urcrete beneath it. Otherwise, one would have expected to see that adjustment fairly rapidly. And the distribution of parent bodies of the MG suite samples. Geophysical delineation of internal structure, again, is important in terms of the transition zone between the lower and upper mantles, assuming that there is such a transition zone. It's a hint of it in the seismic passive seismic data, but it's not yet agreed to by everybody, nor do I think it should be until we get better information. The 3D nature of the core and the core mantle boundary is unknown to us at this time. Timing of core formation and the core dynamo activity, we have hints that it was delayed possibly by as much as 700 million years. But we need a great deal more information about that. Global mapping of datable remnant magnetism is one way in which we can get that information. Now, the magma generation in the upper and lower mantles, investigation of the Procolarum volcanic centers, you're well aware of those centers, including the Aristarchus region, as being important potential objectives for sortie missions. The Mare Basalt Pyroclastic and other eruptive centers, and here I've shown an arrow of down into some southwestern Serenitatis region where there is this appears to be a collapse crater of some kind in which I was able to see a very clear definition, and on the prime film you can see the definition of the layers of different colored pyroclastic deposits. The remote sensing ground truth is a very important part of our future investigations. Remote sensing is getting increasingly sophisticated. I was impressed the other day in seeing the number of sensors that are either there at the moon now or are going to be there, but getting good fundamental ground truth for those sensors is a fundamental objective for future missions. The distribution deposition of polar volatiles, regolith stratigraphy in and near permanent shadow is going to be a very exciting effort. It's exciting not only because of the science that may come from it, particularly in the very deep craters where any polar volatiles have been protected from micrometeorite erosion, at least to some degree, but also in just generally in the polar regions where we do know there's enhanced hydrogen signature and presumably enhanced solar wind volatiles generally. The economic geology of these volatile resources, if hydrogen is enhanced at the poles, more than likely helium-3, helium-4, carbon, nitrogen, and potentially water from cometary impacts are enhanced there as well. So that is a very important from an economic point of view, potential economic point of view, to map these resources in three dimensions in the lunar regolith. There are sort of non-site specific geological questions that need to be investigated: structural, petrological, and dynamical aspects of large impact basins, and the relevance again to the Hadean here on Earth. The broad geological and geotechnical aspects of the regolith is important for future settlement considerations as well as just long-term base operations. The structural and geophysical properties of the mega regolith is something we don't know a great deal about, other than the fact that it exists and that it is seismically very efficient. The old expression we had in Apollo, "The moon rings like a bell," is exactly because of that, the existence and nature of that mega regolith. Geotechnical support for large facility construction is certainly on the agenda as well. There are specific lunar phenomena. The global stress strain history is important and has taken on new importance, I think, in the context of what we are seeing with the preliminary results of the MESSENGER mission, so that we now can do some comparison between two small planets and understand more about the stress strain history of those of those planets. Sinuous rills, ridges, and domes are all of great interest. Mass wasting processes have illustrated down in the lower right-hand corner the avalanche deposit that we investigated on Apollo 17. I suspect that mass wasting is more important than we have given it credit for to date. Recent releases of internal volatiles, I guess this is still something we have to think about more than and may well occur. I have no reason to think it doesn't on occasion, but why and what are those volatiles is something that is well worth consideration. The testing of Mars exploration sampling strategies is certainly a big part of the science agenda as well as the operational agenda. That includes exploration without real-time Earth support. You just have to always put in the back of your mind when we go to Mars, it ain't going to be like Apollo. And it's much more autonomous with respect to both robotic and human exploration. The Earth becomes a great data processor in the sky, which can assist and help in exploration planning, but it's certainly not going to be involved in real time. It is one of those areas, though, where Earth may well be operating telerobotically, operating rovers may well be a way in which they assist the Mars crews in evaluating the plans for the future, for the next day or two or something like that, where rovers can provide, teleoperated rovers from Earth can provide sort of initial evaluation of an EVA plan. Real-time integration of robotic support in planning and operations, test Mars sampling containment strategies. If you can't keep the dust out of your samples, you're certainly not going to keep anything else out of your samples. These are all things we can do on the moon related directly to Mars exploration and sampling strategies. And you also can take life forms of various kinds and organic chemicals and hydrous compounds into an extreme space environment, particularly if you have a lunar base, and you can start to learn a great deal about what might be the effects of exposure to a Martian environment of these same kinds of materials. It's well to know that before you go. It's just probably time then for another walk on the moon to get all this done. Thank you very much.
We have some time for questions if there's anything here for Jack. Yes.
Was it as hard as it looked in those videos that Jose showed
us? It is difficult to work in the A7LB suit. It was even more difficult to work in the A7L suit, which the first three missions had to deal with. There were significant improvements for the J missions. In fact, I think we would be extraordinarily remiss in our obligations to the future if we didn't come up with a much better extravehicular mobility unit or spacesuit. Not just the gloves, although that's the principal concern that I have, but also in the ability to get close to the rocks and get close to the ground and get up. It's fairly easy to get up, but getting bending in that suit, sampling activities, we just have to make it far more efficient. In fact, there are many of the things that were done to document samples that should be done effectively automatically. You should not need to have a Gnomon to place. It might be something you have available as backup along with a small digital camera. But helmet-mounted stereo video, high resolution, both on a rover that's documenting the mesoscale, as Jose said, is I think very critical to increasing the efficiency of field operations on the moon. In fact, I know Dean thinks about this all the time. We all need to think about it. How do you maximize? And the FEET organization, I think, this is one of the main things that they can contribute, along with the training issues. Is how do you maximize the efficiency of field operations on the moon? We got a lot done. We did a heck of a job on Apollo, but we were not very efficient. It was circumstances of the time. We've had 40 years now to work on those technologies and to know what new technologies are available. And helmet-mounted camera systems, heads-up displays in the helmet, far more mobile gloves. All of these, I think, are within reach, and we just really have to work on that within this new suit procurement, as well as within the planning of what kind of field operations you're going to undertake when you actually get there.
Yes, Bill.
The main operational difficulties in working in permanent shadow will be lighting and cold. We're still debating a bit about what the actual temperatures are, but certainly less than 100 Kelvin. And equipment may be an issue for equipment if you're in there very long. Now, working just in shadow, if you have any kind of illuminated surface away from that shadow, you're going to have light in the shadow. The high backscatter characteristics of the lunar surface bring light into the shadow. If you can put your suit into the sunlight, you can reflect light into the shadow. There's no reason why we can't think in terms of artificial illumination for shadow work. I think lighting is probably much less of an issue than this question of how does your equipment hold up if you're in the shadow for any length of time to that extreme cold. To my knowledge, we just don't know right now, and that is another issue for this new suit procurement and all the hardware procurement is to consider that within the specifications. Now, I'm not sure that I would try to make a suit universally capable of working in shadow. That may be a very specialized issue for a specialized suit. I think we at least ought to consider that as being the more cost-effective way to operate, rather than having every suit capable of working in deep shadow. Yes?
When do you think we're realistically going to walk on the moon
again? That's entirely a function of funding. It certainly could be done within 10 years. Whether it will be or not is something I can't predict. We have been underfunded now right from the beginning of the return to the moon effort. Underfunding is the most dangerous thing you can do in any kind of a highly technical program. Not only does it stretch out the schedules, but it means that you do not to pursue options early on that you should pursue to see if they're the things you want to do. In Apollo, we didn't have infinite amount of resources, but at least we had the resources to have parallel engineering design efforts for critical capabilities, and we used those. Sometimes the primary design system, such as the lunar, as the LIM ascent engine, was not meeting test specifications. We would bring on a different engine. And in fact, Neil Armstrong landed on the moon with an ascent engine that had been less than 1 year in the mainline development process, just for that reason. And the shuttle, many of the shuttle problems are due to the underfunding of the shuttle problem in its early days. So underfunding is how you get that message through to Congress and the OMB, I don't know. But right now, I think it's estimated that the return to the moon effort compared to what it was envisioned to be when it was announced by President Bush is about $11 billion down. And that's a heck of an underfunding level, and that's one of the reasons why you're not going to have ISS access, at least not with Orion, until at least 2015. So any of you who get into technical management issues, that's what you got to fight. That's the virus that'll kill you, is underfunding.
I think we're going to have to move on. We're running about 15 minutes behind. We do have some time at the end for some discussion, so we can pick up with other questions at that point. I'm really pleased to introduce our next speaker, Drew Fussell, who, along with his co-author, Matthew